Hello everyone, and welcome to the most punked game dev podcast in the world, House of Games. Today, my host is joined by me, his co-host, you punk. If that shit ain't enough, then go fuck yourself. Just kidding. Come back. We got another punk joining us, Mr. Yaya. A pretty sweet-ass cat, if you ask me. But before this punk get to talk shit, let's punk that door down and start today's episode of House of Games.
Welcome everyone to this week's episode of House of Games, and especially welcome to our special guest, Yahya. I hope I pronounced that right, and please correct me if I did not. First of all, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do, and a little bit about what you do with games?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. My name is Yahya Dambus, and I am originally from Iraq, born in Germany, lived there for a few years, and then was in Dubai for most of my life. And then now I'm in Japan since 7 years ago. I'm a game developer. I've been doing games for around 8 years now. I do like mobile games, PC games, now doing VR games. And in my free time, I work on my own game. It's called Luminous Realms, and we can talk about that later. I do that alongside doing YouTube devlogs and stuff like that. Yeah, that's me.
Cool.
And how long have you been doing game development? How did you start with it?
So like many, many years ago, have any of you guys heard of the game called Little Fighter 2?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite games as a kid.
Yes. So that was the beginning for me, where like I was playing games on PC back in Germany. And then I got this game called Little Fighter 2 on a demo disc, or like one of those magazine discs. And what surprised me with that game was that basically it's a brawler game. What do you call it? Streets of Rage and stuff like that. But the characters are a mix of anime characters like Dragon Ball and stuff. They're not the actual characters, but they're like those kind of characters with powers and stuff and abilities. What was really fascinating for me is when looking through the game's folder and files, I found out that all the sprites and all the data was like exposed, and I was like, whoa. And so like I just, for fun as a kid, I just opened it in MS Paint and started to draw on the sprites. And then when I opened the game, everything was like edited, just like I was drawing in the sprites.
Oh, cool.
So I was like, wow, I'm able to do something and change it in the game. And that was my first experience, like having an actual impact on a game, just being able to do something with it. And from there on, like, I just kept learning different stuff. I did a bunch of mods on this Little Fighter 2, but then also started looking at other games. And it started off a lot with me, like, all the PS2 games or PC games, just exposing all their data and just seeing, like, how models and all the art is made and different things. That was the beginning for me. And then, like, around 9 years ago, I joined the Game Academy, where I started with 3D modeling and stuff, doing characters and environment art. But then also I learned programming and design and a bunch of other things, and that kind of started to get me into learning not just 3D but also all the game stuff, game skills. Over the years I kept honing all the different skills as I worked in different jobs in the game industry. Yeah, now I'm like a bit of a jack of all trades, where I can do programming, art, design, and just a bit of everything here and there.
Funny you mentioned that thing about painting. The way I develop games now is very much like that. For example, in my current game, it's 2D pixel art, but I sort of make a draft of the house, for example, the main character's home, just draw it, right? And now I'm doing the interior design of the house. So I have the exact same thing where I just fix it in Photoshop and then I replace the file that is already in the game, and then all of a sudden it updates itself to the latest one. And that's a very nice feeling. You don't have to go in and redo everything in Unity. It's just replacing the file, and that sort of sounds like what you did, but with the game back then. You replace the files in the game, and voila, it's changing in the game. That's so cool.
Yeah. Even nowadays, like, it's the same thing with all the art assets. When you work with 3D Max or Blender or Photoshop and all these different things, you just, like, change it from your program, and then, broop, it just updates in the game engine.
It's very satisfying.
It's sweet to hear that somebody else had childhood memories from Little Fighters 2, and that they also had all of the art and a lot of stuff exposed, so you could mod it in real time, almost, which is a really, really fun thing. But I'm curious, since you do a lot of everything when it comes to game development, what part do you like the most, or where are you the best?
And also, one more thing to add to those questions. What part do you have at the company you're currently working at? Do you have a specific part, or are you a jack of all trades there as well?
At my company, depending on the time, which project I'm working at and which phase, I do different things. Like during certain pre-production phases, I may be a lot of prototyping and creating a lot of R&D stuff. And then later on through development, I might be doing a bit of design, art, programming. I would say like the thing that I am best at would be R&D, rapid prototyping, and then level design. That's just something I've been doing a lot recently, and also in the past on previous projects like mobile game and some other PC games I've made. And that's just something I really enjoy doing, creating different levels and keep reiterating on it and like going back and fixing it. That's a really fun process for me.
What does R&D stand for?
Research and development. Testing out things, researching them. I'm doing it like constantly, whether it's for my projects or for company projects, just trying out different technologies, trying out new or old techniques. One thing I really love to do is look at old N64 era, PS2 era games and just see all the crazy techniques that they did back then to get their games optimized, or just do all these cool tricks, try to recreate them in modern day hardware. And it can be very beneficial to optimize the game. It's just fascinating to look at old techniques as well.
I've got to ask, since you live in Japan now, you say you like level design the most. We talked to a guest a couple of weeks ago, the latest episode that came out when we're recording this, about level design. And I start talking about how the Japanese society is built, the cities and everything. I said it's a lot of fences everywhere, so you can't really... If you look at Google Map and you want to go to this other side of this block, you know there's going to be a damn fence somewhere, so you will still walk around the block to get there. I think you recognize yourself.
Yes.
So now my question is, do you feel like living in Japan have helped you or made you change how you design stuff? But I suppose you have lived here while you started working with games. But do you think that impacted it at all, how you design levels and so on?
Yes, definitely. Before I came to Japan like 7 years ago, I was living in Dubai for like, was it 14 years, 12 years? And Dubai is just desert and city. There's not really much else. So it's quite boring in terms of like level design. It's very flat as well, Dubai, the city itself. But in Tokyo or Japan, there's so much like different environment. And within the city, there's parks and nature. And outside of it, there's so many mountains and this nature everywhere and different terrain everywhere. So it's very, very inspiring just in general to live here, see everything. I wouldn't say it's like a playground, but it's definitely quite a big difference compared to Dubai.
I compare living in Tokyo is like living inside the internet. You can just open your door and walk outside and say, what the fuck am I going to do today? And you know it's going to be out there, just like, you know, when you go online.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There's just everything. Every weird stuff is out here.
Yeah, good and bad. Everything.
Yes.
Yeah. Something you said about optimization and old systems, how they did it back in the day, which I don't know if I have talked about it on this podcast before, but that reminds me of a kind of funny trick that they did with, I think, the first Final Fantasy game, where they did an optimization because they wanted random numbers for different things. For example, how much damage you take, things like that. The way that that programmer did it, because the hardware at the time couldn't generate random numbers on the fly because it wasn't nearly as powerful as you required it to be. So instead, what he did, he just generated, I think it was something like 32 random numbers, and then put them in the list. And every time the game needs a random number, it just takes one from the list and then moves the cursor over to the next one. So the next time it's gonna use random number 2 and so on. And it just goes like that, which is really fascinating how it works. You would never be able to guess it if you didn't know that he did it like that. Really interesting.
Yeah, I watched YouTube the other day about the NES and all its limitations and the different techniques people did to optimize their games. And one of the sections was about how to do random numbers and how there was no built-in function for that on the NES. So people just had to figure it out. The guy in the video talked about I forgot his name. This was an Iranian programmer who actually worked on many of the Final Fantasy games back then. He did this technique that was very like, you know, if it ain't broke, why fix it? You know, it works. It's not the best way, but it works.
Yeah, exactly. So was it when you did the education that you got into working with games professionally, or how did you accomplish that?
Yeah, I studied in Abu Dhabi, the city next to Dubai. They had a Ubisoft Gaming Academy there. They shut down the year after I finished it. So I got lucky when I got there. But yeah, that was the point when I entered that academy. That was the point where it was like, okay, this is like a legit career path that I can do. Before that, it was just me playing around with PC, doing mods and just trying to learn stuff and skills, but never really knew where that's going to take me. I just enjoy doing it. But then when I entered that academy, I was like, all right, this is legit. I can actually work in this kind of career. And after I graduated from that, I joined like a mobile company in Abu Dhabi, where we made a puzzle game for a mobile game. That was my first proper full-time job in the game industry. After that, I moved to Japan, and then I continued working here as well.
Did you get the job here in Japan before you came here, or was that after the fact?
After the fact, I first came and studied the language. I did get like a whole month, a year and a half almost, like just learning the language first, because very important. Because when I came to Japan, I already had decided I want to stay here. It wasn't like testing it out. I immediately packed up all my stuff. I got my PS4. And like, I was like, all right, I'm going there and I come back.
Oh, nice. Can you tell us what you're working on now? Are you allowed to? Or I think I know since I met you just a few weeks ago, but...
Yes, at the company where I work at right now, it's called the Universe. It's a, like play on word. It's like Uni and then VRS. So it's like, a, you know, VR.
Ah.
Oh, right.
I get it.
Yeah.
There we make anime VR games. Our previous game was Little Witch Academia, if you guys know about that anime. We made like a broom VR racing game for it in 2020. And actually, if you go to Akihabara or anywhere in Japan and get an Oculus or Meta Quest 2, you can actually see our game in the back of the box. It's one of the 6 games they have as a picture there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's always like something cool. And I go to shops and I was like, I show it to friends like, oh, check this out. It's our game.
Oh, very interesting.
And now we're working on Attack on Titan VR.
Yes.
Wow. That's cool to work on such a huge IP.
Yeah.
Yes. It's pretty fun. I can't say anything about any details, but yeah, it will be coming out and I hope people will enjoy it.
Yeah. I can imagine it's going to be pretty wild as an experience just from seeing the anime.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really looking forward to hearing more about that as it comes out.
I can't wait to cut off a Titan's dick in VR.
No comment.
They don't have dicks. I'm watching the anime now. I started that a week. It's so good.
Yeah. That's like one thing for me. Any company I plan to work with or any project, it's got to be something that I am comfortable with working. I'm Muslim, so I have certain rules, certain standards that I don't like to cross. And it's got to be something, like for example, naked characters can't do that. But in Attack on Titan, it's fine because they're not exactly naked.
Interesting.
In my side game, like I want to keep it very family friendly, nothing too adult, something where also anyone can play it, kids or adults, and everybody can enjoy it.
So I guess working for my company is a big no-no.
Yeah, no, I don't know about your games, man. It's cool and all, but yeah. But I look forward to seeing your new game. It sounds cool last time you told me about it.
Yeah, it's very family friendly, so you're welcome to come and join us. Join my one-man army at some point.
So do you want to tell us more about your own project and your own games, what you're working on currently or what you've done in the past?
Yeah, so for me in general, even when I have a full-time job, I like to keep myself busy also in my free time and work on a side project to just keep honing my skills, learning new things, trying out new stuff. Because when you work in a company, you're not always making something new or stuff. Like sometimes you just have to do like a routine kind of job. Doesn't always allow for much, leveling up in your skills.
Exploration, perhaps.
Yes, I always like to keep myself busy. And up until a few years ago, most of my side projects were just for fun, just to learn stuff, try new stuff. But ever since 2020 or 2019, me and my friend here in Japan, we started to work on a VR game, me and him together in our free time. That actually was the commercial product. 2 years later, in 2022, in February January, we released the game properly. That was my first game proper released, commercial product, yeah.
What is it called?
Monster Showdown. It's like a Call of Duty zombies survival kind of game, but in VR. There isn't much games like that, so we just saw an opportunity. Like, oh, we can create that in VR. So that should be fun. It started off as a completely different gameplay. It was kind of like shooter, but also with a sword and stuff. But feature creep really got to us, and eventually we were just like, let's scrap all the unnecessary stuff and just make the most basic. Just focus on the fun part and just make that, finish the game and move on. There was a good life lesson there because we just kept going and the game was going nowhere. And we were like, either we drop it or we just pull through and finish it. And we decided like, okay, let's just pull through just to teach ourselves to like, when we start something, we finish it.
Very nice.
Yeah, we both had started many projects in the past, me and my friend, and just never finished them. So this was like a lesson for us, like, okay, now we finish it. That's it. We finish it. There is no excuse.
Yeah, that's a lesson I have to learn. I think I've worked on a game with my brother, and this is the second game, actually. But because of life and also a little bit because of this podcast, you don't have time to work on it anymore. So I also think that one of the most difficult but rewarding things is releasing when it comes to indie games. It's hard to get it all the way there.
Yeah.
Kudos to pulling through.
Thank you, thank you. It's a really big part. We always very underestimate. We feel like, oh, if I can make it, that means I can also release it. But it's a completely different thing to just release a game. There's marketing, there's social media, there's contacting all the journalists and streamers, content creators, sending them keys, setting up pages like Steam page, and then releasing the game, updating it, bug fixing, feedback. It's a huge thing. You really start to understand the scale of how much a game takes after you release at least one time fully yourself. You just understand more like, okay, next time I think, oh, let me just add this feature. There's never a just for anything. Like, it all piles up.
No, of course.
Yeah. It's just, it gives more perspective, yeah.
I told this story on this podcast before, but our common friend Louis here in Tokyo, I think he told you as well, but when he started as a publisher, his idea was to work making games and publishing games. But it's like what you say, it's just so much more work than just making the game. Everything around it, that's almost more work than just making the damn game. So he ended up moving away from developing games and just publishing. And that's true what you say, there's just so much work with all of it, everything that surrounds the game itself.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, just games in general, you see the music industry, all right, you create music, and then there's also the marketing part, and there's movie, and that's also another thing. Like, movies are quite complex as well, but games, it's like, it's everything. There's music, many games have cutscenes, story, there's gameplay, there's programming, you have to Q&A, R&D, bug fixing, and then releasing it, and then community management. It's crazy. I feel like this one reason why it's one of the biggest industries, bigger than movies and music combined. It's so massive. And that's why also, like, in the game industry, you can almost find every kind of job. Because it's just, we use it all. Everything can go into games.
I want to touch on your blogs. I checked a couple of them yesterday and then a couple of more today. In the last one you made, you mentioned how you managed to make this, you call it like a loop, so you can play the game from start to finish.
Yes.
When I saw that, I started writing down what I would need to do in order to get to that point where I can start play my game from start to finish. And when I write that down on a piece of paper, that's when I realize how damn big this game is, after all. This leads me to my next question. Also in that video, you sort of made fun of yourself for always talking about changing the fighting mechanic in your current project. You talked about that for many episodes, that you're going to change the fighting mechanics, and you keep talking, and it never happens, and eventually it happened. My point is, do you feel like in your current project, have you cut off a lot of stuff from it, or do you feel like you can keep all the things you have in mind for the full release of the game, or do you feel like you have to cut things out?
That's a good question. The game was on a certain track until last year in November, and then it shifted a lot, where in my latest devlog I talked about it, where I shifted to open world ideas I had and that loop you talked about. But then around a month ago I had a big shift again, where it was like this whole shift that I had since November was not working out. It was not like the game changed too much, where I no longer became what I wanted it from the beginning, and I was just working on it to get it done. That's a bad sign. You know something's not right when you're just working on it just to get it done. It's a game. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be fun making it as well. Us as indie developers, we're making it. Not working for a company, working on it on our own for passion. So if it's not enjoyable, then you're not doing it right, I feel. So I kind of shifted back to the older design. And to give a quick overview of what the game is, it's called Luminous Realms, and is very heavily inspired by my favorite game since childhood called Kingdom Hearts, specifically inspired by the PS2 era, Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. The game has kept going on since then. There was Kingdom Hearts 3 and like a bunch of other games that came out a few years ago, but it has completely changed the gameplay. And it's still similar, but there are still a huge fan base who still go back to the old one and keep playing it. And there's a big reason why, because the gameplay, people love it much more. It's much more snappy, much more arcade-like, where the new one is more flashy and nice looking, but it changed a lot, where it's no longer like the older ones. And I kind of wanted to recreate that in modern day. So that's my game, basically. So I'm taking a lot of inspiration from the older Kingdom Hearts games, of having platforming levels. That was the big inspiration for Kingdom Hearts. It was basically Mario 64 plus Final Fantasy. So I'm creating platforming levels and worlds, and then also creating like an RPG, action RPG system with battle mechanics, combos and weapons, items, all that kind of stuff. And with a bunch of exploration, and ideally also in the future, I would add story to it. Probably not going to be anywhere close to the high quality like Disney production that they have in Kingdom Hearts, but I would like to have some story I want to tell in the game, so that'll be hopefully something good. But yeah, in November I had shifted to more open world, like kind of Breath of the Wild. I wanted to mix it up a bit, like Breath of the Wild with Kingdom Hearts, but it changed too much, and I was just hating everything and I was like, this is not good. So I just pulled back a bit, tried to work on the older style again, and I was like, you know, that this is actually what I love the most. So that's what I'm working on now. Actually, 2 weeks ago, there was a game event here in Tokyo, and I showcased one of the latest demos I made that was in the Kingdom Hearts style. People really loved that as well. So that was very reaffirming for me.
You mentioned that in your next vlog that you're moving back, or did you do that in the latest one, that you're moving back to the sort of original?
Yeah, so that's really... annoying thing. I had just released the latest devlog where I very specifically said, oh, I'm going to switch to open world. And then 2 weeks later, I was like, no, I'm going to go back. So I'm like, should I take down the devlog? Should I make a quick update? I was like, you know what? Screw it. Just leave it there. When I'm ready to make the next devlog, I'll make it. And in that, I'll mention how I switched back. What I like to do in my devlogs is not just have them, hey, guys, what's going on? And here's the latest thing that I'm working on. No, I like to have them like, each one is telling a lesson from my mistakes or something I learned, so that people can watch it individually, not necessarily having to follow the dev logs from the beginning. I don't feel the need to immediately make a follow-up just to update everybody, but instead learn the lesson and work on what I have now. And when I feel like I got something new to show and to teach, I make the next.
Speaking of the devlogs, that's something I want us to start doing as well. That's what I told you when we met live 2-3 weeks ago at the games meetup in Tokyo. But I wonder, your devlogs are really high production. They're really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
I didn't think about it until you said it now, that they're also very educational. I realize that now, that yeah, you are teaching stuff as well. That's not anywhere near what I'm planning to do. I was just gonna make it as simple as possible, but I do wonder, how long does it take to make one of those vlogs? And also, when you develop the game, do you keep in mind that you're gonna make a vlog, so you hit the record button once in a while, or do you record all the things you want to show off in the vlog when it's time to make the vlog?
All right, so there's a bunch of questions, so I'll start with them one by one. Firstly, in terms of the style I made it, the devlogs, and how you want to make it, just design it however you like it, because if you try to imitate me or some other of the devlog peoples, you're just going to be a copy. You can take inspiration from here and there, that's good, but in the end, just make something that you enjoy, because you don't want to be hating what you do. You want to be enjoying it, and when you enjoy it, it shows. People will see the video as fun. In general, when it comes to making devlogs, I also highly recommend it for any indie developer. It is a huge and really good tool for marketing your game. I'm still, like, I would say I'm 10% into developing the entire game, and I already have almost like 3,000 wishlists on Steam. A big number of those came from a video that someone else made about my game, one of the biggest YouTubers for Kingdom Hearts. So that got me a huge number of wishlists. But again, that's one reason also why to make YouTube videos about your games, because the way that guy found out about my game was through one of my devlogs, which for some reason started to blow up like in December last year. It's over 100,000 views now. It started off at just like 3,000 views for several months, and then just suddenly, I don't know why, in Christmas, people just love watching stuff on YouTube.
Just 3,000 views, even that is amazing. I was shocked to see how many views you had. Not that you're not a very good person in terms of what you do, but you know, when you told me you had a blog and I checked it out, I was like, Jesus Christ, there's so many views. And I imagine a lot of them are Kingdom Hearts fans that are sharing you on as well, which is really cool.
Yes, and I would say that's like the biggest, probably, how do you say, hook for my game, is that it's a Kingdom Hearts-like game, which there haven't been a single one so far. And I actually used to wonder, why has no company tried to make a game like Kingdom Hearts? And now as I developed the game, I realized why, because it's a very complex kind of game to make. Like, it's very, very tough. Their battle system is incredibly complex. Even all the players who play the Kingdom Hearts games, like 20 years later now, after the first game came out, they're still finding out systems that we didn't know about that are in the first and second game.
Wow.
And it's just like, man, this game is so deep and complex. So yeah, that's a big hook for my game. I am one of those fans. I love those games and I want to see all those old ones again. So yeah, that's like a good pull for the game. Going back to the devlogs, you were asking about the production. Yes. So my first devlog, which is the longest one, is almost 8 minutes. That one took around 3 weeks to make.
Wow.
And that was every day 2 to 3 hours working on it. So it took quite a while. Just to preface though, that was in terms of the videos I've made so far on my YouTube devlog, it was my fifth video. I had initially 2 tutorial videos I made just to get things started on my channel. And then I made 2 remake games just for fun. One was Ape Escape PS1 remake to make it look like PS5. And then I made Pepsi Man remake, just the first levels. And that one actually got 1.2 million views.
Very nice.
Yeah, I checked that out today. It's insane.
Yeah, that one, I cannot explain why. This game is so old. Never left Japan. And for some reason, people in South America, in the Middle East, and all over the world know about the game. So yeah, it's a weird anomaly. But yeah, so like that was my fifth video when I started my devlog for my game. So I had a bit of experience already. And it did, although, take a long time. It got a bit faster with my next video after that, which was around 2 weeks it took me. And then the one after took me around 1 week. And the recent one took a bit a little longer because I was changing it up a bit, where I was just working in 30-minute chunks every day. But yeah, overall, it just depends on how you want to structure them and how much time you want to invest into it. But I would say over time, as you start to get your own style, as you develop it, you kind of also get better at like making those kind of videos, and it just gets faster. I would say focus on having it be fun. Enjoy the process. If you're not enjoying the process, you're doing something wrong.
So I do not as widely viewed or as professional, but I do a blog about the game I'm making together with my brother. I'm just curious how your process of making these videos are. For me, while I'm coding, I'm just copy-pasting back and forth between Visual Studio and the Medium.com editor, and just writing some notes on what I'm doing in the blog, and then just continue programming, and then going back and writing some more on what my thought process is. And then at the end, when I've done the feature or fixed the bug or whatever it is, I just rewrite the whole blog into something coherent and take out the stuff that is irrelevant and make a red thread through the whole thing. So is that how you do your videos, or do you sit down and write the script and then make the video, or what is your process like?
While I am just working on the game between dev vlogs, I try to, as much as I can, whenever I'm working on a feature that looks interesting or I can make it look interesting in video, I immediately try to record it and post it on social media, both on Twitter, YouTube, community section, and Instagram. That, of course, helps get more people interested in the game. At the same time, I get a list of videos that I have for future devlogs that I can show again, so I don't have to like re-record videos for when it comes to making the videos. I do still end up recording a few new videos, but overall, I would have this kind of timeline of new features and stuff I've worked on through these short videos that I record. When it does come to doing a new video, if I don't have a specific idea what I want to talk about, I will just open up a Google document and start writing out all the new features I added or all the new things I've created in the game ever since the last devlog. And I just have a look at it and see what kind of story I can tell with all these new things. I always have a story for each video. So for the first video, it was making a Kingdom Hearts-like game. That was the story. So I talked about it in that way. And then the second one was how I implemented this gameplay ability system. It's a bit more deeper or complex topic, but it basically helped me be able to pull off an action RPG game that has like over 100 abilities. And then a second video was about me implementing the combat system and discovering how Kingdom Hearts has this special combo system that other games don't usually have. In the latest video, it talked about how indie games can also create open world kind of games, where they're kind of mini open worlds. So it's kind of like that. I tell a story in each different video, and I try to come up with these stories when I list up all the things that I've created so far since the last devlog, just to get like an idea of what material I can use and what kind of story I can create using those kind of things.
Do you have a schedule when you release the devlogs, or do you release them when you have something to show? I think you said that before. There's not like once a month or anything like that.
Initially, I wanted to do once a month. And last year, I was much more harder on myself to try to like really go hard on this YouTube and solo indie game dev kind of thing. But last year and continuing on to this year, I was very stressed with everything. And I was feeling like I'm pushing myself too much, and I start to like not enjoy anything anymore in life. So I was like, okay, this is not the right thing to do, because I already have a full-time job and it's paying me good. And I don't necessarily like need to make this a full-time indie thing. It can eventually happen, but I shouldn't push too hard. I already enjoy my full-time job. I'm doing game dev and I'm doing something fun. So I'm now switching it a bit to take it a bit more easy. That goes also for my devlogs, where I'm not going to force myself to make a devlog if there is nothing interesting to talk about. So having a monthly schedule would kind of degrade the quality. It might give more content for viewers, but kind of would also degrade like the quality of it. So kind of the quality over quantity thing.
I'm also curious about the Ape Escape remake you made in Kingdom Hearts and the Pepsi Runner game. I recently read this story about Nintendo suing the shit out of someone who made some sort of fan-made game out of Zelda or Mario, whatever. Are you scared that you get sued for any of this? And also, how long does it take to make those Ape Escape and Pepsi game, for example?
The Pepsi Man game took like 1.5 months of working like 2 hours every day. And then the Ape Escape one took around 2 months. So the Pepsi Man one, I was much more scared about the legal stuff because it's Pepsi. It's pretty huge. So only the video actually has Pepsi Man in it. You can download the game, but the game you would download is Soda Man.
Okay.
Where I switched out the logo and the character.
Oh, smart one.
Yeah. So just to avoid that part, if at some point Pepsi comes to me and says, hey, can you remake this old game? I wouldn't say no. But I think I should be all right. Of course, any company can sue anyone. And it doesn't always have to be like a legal reason why. They can just sue you and maybe you'll win in the end, but you'll be bankrupt.
Yeah.
So there is no safe way. But, you know, hopefully they wouldn't come this far. I don't think I'm damaging their brand with what I made. And for Ape Escape, I did actually release the demo as is because I think, again, it just would maybe help. It wouldn't really damage the brand of PlayStation. I don't think they care as much as, like, Pepsi is very brand-oriented, but Ape Escape, like, it is part of PlayStation, but they don't really, it's not an ongoing IP. So I don't think so.
Yeah, Disney and Nintendo seem to be really strict about these types of things.
Yeah. So that's like where I get a lot of comments on YouTube or everywhere where people are like, oh, aren't you afraid you're going to get sued? And I'm like, this is not Kingdom Hearts. It's a game that's inspired by it. There's so many Dark Souls-like games. You know, Sonic has a bunch of games that are like it. Like this one called Freedom Something. There's also like another Mega Man Battle Network-inspired game. There's a bunch of Mario, like, what do you call it? A Hat in Time. You guys know about that game?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one is pretty much like Mario 64. I think it's just because I'm the first one and there hasn't been anyone before me who's made a game like Kingdom Hearts. So everybody's just like, oh, you're copying them. You're going to get sued. But I'm sure like the first guy who tried to make a Dark Souls-like game, they would say the same thing to them. But now it's just a genre, you know, just like Metroidvania games and any other genre. I think as long as I stay away from patented stuff, like that's one thing I learned where... And first, one of the things I recreated was the command menu. If you guys have played Kingdom Hearts, you know what it is. Where you can choose the commands. You can do like the action, magic, items and stuff. And I initially had that in my game, but then I was like, you know what? Let me look into the software patents that Square Enix has. And I had to look through almost 300 different patents. And yeah, it turns out they have that patented since 2007. And it's not going to expire until 2027. So I was like, yeah, let me just remove that one. And I made sure also all the other things that they have patented that I don't include in my game. I think from that side, that would be the biggest worry is the patented stuff.
Yeah, but that's kudos to doing your due diligence on that. Because if it were me, if I did something inspired by another game and did some kind of menu or something that's inspired, I would never bother to check. I would just do it and hope for the best, I guess. So that's very good that you did it the proper way.
But isn't that a damn shame, though, that you can patent that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the thing. Firstly, like doing it properly would be to talk to a lawyer. So I haven't yet done it properly.
Yeah, right.
And if I eventually do it properly, I might get a lawyer to make sure nothing is going against anything. But at the same time, when it comes to patents, like physical patents for inventions, physical inventions, that's an established thing that's been around for over 100 years. But software patents are very vague because...
Yeah, they sort of describe an idea, I suppose, rather than a thing.
Exactly. When it comes to like a patent, let's say for, I don't know, like a wheel for a car, you can immediately show the exact dimensions, the materials you've used and all this stuff to show like, this is mine, I've made this. And if you make something like it, I can sue you for it. But with software, it's harder because what are you going to put the code? But then people can copy it. Even if you put the code, there is a million ways of coding something. So people can just recode it in a different way. It's very vague. I tried to look through the history of video game patents, and they've only ever been two times where patents were used in a lawsuit. In those times, it was like a very blatant ripoff. There was one where it was like, you guys remember Crazy Taxi, made by Sega. Then there was one of the Simpsons game, not Hit and Run, another one, where you drive as a taxi driver and you take people different places in Springfield. That was like almost one-to-one Crazy Taxi with just some differences in the characters' looks and stuff. So in that case, Sega used one of their patents as an excuse to sue them. But they can't technically sue them for just, hey, it's like Crazy Taxi, you know, because it's not one-on-one copying it like you would for a product, for example. In the end, actually, they didn't win or lose. They just paid them outside of court. So there isn't a precedence yet, proper precedence for software patents. Well, you know, it's always best to cover yours. It's important to always talk to a lawyer. If you're actually trying to do a business, make sure you have everything legally secured. I would advise everybody to do that. As I get closer to making my game bigger and proper, I will take more steps to make sure I'm on the safe side of things.
It's just a damn shame. We call this art, the things we're working on, and then we can patent it. Bigger players in the industry, they have the money and time and lawyers to patent everything, and then the smaller ones can't even get through all of that. I think it's just absolute bullshit that you can patent anything like this. I think it should be, anyone can copy whatever you want. It's just games at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, imagine other art having similar patents, so you would have somebody saying like, oh, well, my paintings are made by doing this brush stroke, and if you do that, I'll sue you and take all your paintings or something. It's sort of absurd because it is an idea, and it can, then you would have to state it so broadly, and by doing that, you would just outlaw so many things that, you know, weird, very weird, I think.
Speaking of patents, while I was researching the whole thing, I looked at the origin of patents, and the original idea is actually in favor of small creators, because in the US, they create the whole patent law to protect creators and their inventions, and to give them at least 20 years to make their idea become a proper product. Imagine, let's say you come up with a very groundbreaking invention, and then you present the prototype, you know, you're trying to get investors maybe or someone, and then someone sees it and that's it. Okay, they got like a whole factory ready, they have a whole company ready, they'll just copy it in a month or two, they have it on the market, done. There goes your idea that you've worked on for the last 10 years. So in that case, the patent will protect you as a small creator to have at least 20 years to get this into a proper product. So in that way, I understand why this exists. It's to protect us. But unfortunately, like sometimes there are the patent trolls and some companies maybe make use of it. But yeah, I feel like there is a precedence for it. Yeah.
No, I totally agree with that. It totally sounds reasonable, the example you laid out there, especially when it comes to physical products. No one can just make something out of thin air. Probably it's going to happen that a big company make it first. But now I feel like it's almost reversed in the gaming industry where you have the big companies. I had never heard about a small indie dev patent anything. It's almost the reversed. You read, for example, Sony's experts that just patent shitloads of stuff and they don't even make them. It's like these patent stuff for the sake of patenting them. That's a shame.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing where they just like, they troll, where, not troll, but like they went to copyright, for example, the copyright system where they were like copywriting Let's Plays in secret. They weren't like doing publicly, of course, but people, when they found out, they were like, what the hell? Let's Plays was made by YouTubers, you know, no one owns this. Why are you coming here copywriting it? So that sucks when they do that. But then like also when it comes to, for example, inventions or software, companies do invest millions and billions to create their stuff for R&D. So I do see why maybe they also want to protect their inventions or discoveries and stuff.
True that too, when it's like software inventions. I was just thinking more like the one you mentioned, like the design HUD of Kingdom Hearts games or whatever. Or like Tekken, the original Tekken games, you know, in the loading scene you play this alien evasion game while the game was loading. And I think that was a patent that just ran out. That sounds a bit too much, but yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
And to reference back to something you said, Rune, a little while back, is that small creators don't patent stuff. And I think somebody will have to correct me on this, but I think to patent something, the threshold is kind of high, so you need millions of dollars of lawyer fees and a lot of know-how to patent something in the first place. So it's almost currently made for... It's only possible to do it once you have a big company.
It's actually not that expensive.
Isn't it?
The process is a bit long, but it's nowhere close to millions. It's not even hundreds of thousands, I would say. There are different kind of patents. You can actually do a Google patent for just $100. But of course, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But it's just the process. For example, the command menu I was talking about for Kingdom Hearts, that one, they applied for it in 2005 or 2004. And they only got it after 3 years. So it's the process is very long. So for an indie to do it, it doesn't really make much sense when they don't even know if their game is going to sell. But for a company, you know, they're like, okay, this is a business. We know we're going to be around after 5 to 10 years. So we should patent our stuff. So that's why companies do it more often. And also indies are more open where they're like, hey, take my stuff, do whatever you want. Sharing is caring. So it's a bit more different mentalities.
But I guess one thing, silver lining to all of these software patents, I guess, is that once the original ones runs out, so say, for example, having a game in a loading sequence, once they run out, I guess you would have to get more and more specific because you can't re-patent something, I hope, that has already run out. So I guess then at some point you would have less and less of these problems since you would have more and more specific patents because you can't invent something after it's already been invented, I suppose.
Yes, but unfortunately the system is a little bit broken where if you change the slightest thing, you can patent it again and...
Oh, right, of course.
I've heard pharmaceutical companies do that and... They keep like...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But I would say overall software companies are... Like I said, I haven't seen a precedent where they just write out sue people or stuff like this.
Something that also is related that you said a while back. At first, when a company makes a game, or an indie for that matter, and then when there's only one of them, say, for example, Dark Souls... That's just one game, but when people start making copies, that's when it comes to genre. And that's something that I've really enjoyed to see nowadays, that for example with Dark Souls games, or Souls-like, or what you would call them. But also, something that I remember growing up is SimCity, for example, was one franchise, and there was no other games that would want to touch that until Paradox came out with Cities Skylines. And now it's the same thing with The Sims, where it's been just a one franchise genre forever. And now Paradox, again, is doing the same thing and doing a competing product. And I saw also, I don't remember what the name is, but I'll make sure to link it in the description. There's also an indie game that is making a sort of The Sims game, or what you would call the genre.
Oh, yes, I saw that one. It had a Kickstarter, right?
Yeah. So it's really nice that there's competition. I really like that things aren't... Because it felt like, for example, the Sims games, that they were sort of untouchable. But if it would be 15 games that does sort of the same thing, then you could also feel more secure in doing something like it and not be sued for copyright or patent, whatever, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It just takes the first few people to step in and give it a shot. Mario Kart was a big thing when Mario Kart came out, but now there's a bunch of games like it. Did anyone come and say, Crash Bandicoot was copying them when they did their own racing game.
Yeah, exactly. It is such an interesting discussion, so I would want to keep it even longer, but we're sort of running out of time. One of the things I would just want to ask you before we end the episode. So with the content that you do, for example, your YouTube videos. So for me, part of the reason that I do marketing that way is that I also use it sort of as a rubber duck. I've spoken about it on this podcast before, that it helps you think more objectively about the problems that you're trying to solve, and therefore you manage to solve them quicker because you tell and explain to somebody else what you're trying to do. Do you experience the same thing, or is it another process completely for you since you're doing video instead of text?
Yeah, I would say it's a bit more different. I don't feel as much of the rubber duck feeling. It does feel more like kind of journaling what I'm making. Sometimes I do look back on the older videos and it's like interesting to see where it all started and how it grew. Eventually, I'm hoping when the game releases, for people who buy the game who have no idea about the devlogs, this will be like a very interesting behind the scenes for them where they get to see how this game started and evolved. And going back to looking a lot like another game, many big companies straight up start off as another game when they just first R&D it, you know, in the prototyping phase, the pre-production phase, because, you know, they want to try a new concept and they liked a certain game style. And so they created that. You never see that. You see the game only 2 or 3 years later when it's completely changed and became unique on its own with the elements of those other games. That's why, like, you don't see it as much except with indies, because we share a lot of our process when we work on games and we make devlogs like this. So you see from day one how the game starts, what it's inspired by, and then how it over time grows to become its own thing and becomes its own product and game.
I like that take on it. After I released the Red Colony games in particular, I was on a couple of podcasts and they asked me questions how it all began and stuff like that. I kept giving different answers depending on the podcast because it was I wasn't quite sure. But I think it's now that I'm thinking to make my own devlog about my current project, I like what you said there, that the people who have never seen the vlogs, they will hopefully enjoy the game, and then they find out about these vlogs and they can see how much changed to the final product versus what it was, you know, 2 years earlier. The only problem I have with my vlog is my games tend to be quite story driven, not Knife Boy, but this current project in particular. And it's just one angle I'm gonna go for in this devlog is to sort of introduce different characters in each vlog and also show progress in the game. I never really thought about doing it more educational like you do. I don't think I can do that because I used trial and error type of programmer and developer. I always think about that as well. I don't want to spoil too much, but at the same time, there are people who will never see these vlogs and it won't be spoiled for them anyways. I think that's quite difficult to balance. Just thinking out loud here.
Yeah, I totally get you. You'll just have to figure out your style. If your thing is not teaching, if your game is not like every devlog is a new feature, that's fine. You'll just find your own style, how you bring this entertaining videos to people or devlogs to people. Also, you'll see how people react to them and what they like. And based on that, you can also like script your videos in a different way. That's both fun for them and you. In the end, make sure it is fun for you first and foremost. That's just me, like, when you do a full-time job at a company, you're already doing something where it's not always going to be fun for you. But, you know, in the end, you get paid, so it's fine. But when you're doing your own thing, you're trying to start your own business or your own game, it should be something you enjoy. Because at that point, if you're not, like, just go get a normal job, you know?
And that, I think, is a very nice wrap-up for the episode. Before we end it, though, would you want to promote anything or send our listeners anywhere, perhaps promote your game or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. Follow me on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. It's all Yahya Dambos. I guess maybe you guys will have a description or somewhere in your podcast, hopefully, so you guys can see that there. And if you want to follow my game, you can just follow my Luminous Realms hashtag for the game. That's about it.
Cool.
Perfect. We will absolutely make sure to link that everywhere we can in the description so nobody misses it. If you are listening, just look below and it should be on top of the description. As a final note, I would just like to thank you so much for being our guest for this episode. It was very interesting, and I wish we had time for 3 hours instead of one, but you're most welcome back for another follow-up episode.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Ruin, for being my co-host as always.
Hi.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.